Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. I'm Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today, we're diving into the fascinating world of heraldry, coats of arms, colorful shields, and the question of why knights started using such elaborate ways to identify themselves in the first place.
Exactly. And to understand that, we first need to picture the problem. You're standing on a medieval battlefield. Hundreds of fighters, all in chainmail, later in plate armor. Helmets covering their entire faces. Now tell me, whose friend, whose foe?
That really is a massive problem. I know this from reenactment. Even when you know what your opponent looks like, as soon as the helmet goes down, you can't recognize anyone anymore. And we're talking maybe 20, 30 people. Imagine that with 1,000.
Complete chaos. And that's exactly why they needed a system. But here's the interesting part. The idea of using symbols on shields is much, much older than the Middle Ages.
You mean antiquity?
The ancient Greeks, yes. As early as the 6th century BC, they had so-called parasema, official symbols of their city-states, known mainly from coins. Athens, for example, had the owl, the symbol of the goddess Athena. Sparta?
The famous lambda.
The lambda for Lacedaemon, exactly. Though that's only documented from the late 5th century onward. Corinth is associated with Pegasus, Thebes with the Sphinx, at least on coins. And here's the fascinating part. These were collective identifiers. Not, this is the shield of warrior so-and-so, but these are the Spartans. Those are the Athenians.
So more like a uniform than a personal coat of arms. In the phalanx, everyone needed to know who was standing next to them.
That's exactly the point. The Greeks solved a military problem with this. But it wasn't yet personal heraldry as we know it from later periods. That came... Well, you have to be careful with the dates.
When exactly?
The Bayeux Tapestry, which depicts the events of 1066 but was probably made in the 1070s, is often cited as the starting point. But if you look closely on this nearly 70-meter-long embroidered work, you can see shields with patterns, crosses, stripes, dots. But these aren't true coats of arms.
No personal attribution?
No. The warriors on the tapestry are identified by inscriptions, not by their shield designs. These are simply decorative patterns, Norman and Anglo-Saxon ornaments. True personal heraldry, symbols tied to a specific person that can be inherited, that only develops about 50 to 100 years later.
So around 1130, 1150?
Geoffrey Plantagenet of Anjou is considered one of the earliest documented examples, in 1128, when he was knighted by Henry I in Rouen, he received a shield with golden lions on a blue background. We even still have an enamel plaque from Le Mans, dated 1151, showing him with that exact shield. There we have a coat of arms that was actually inherited. And from the Second Crusade onward, meaning the mid-12th century, the whole system became standardized.
That makes sense, timing-wise. Armor was becoming increasingly enclosed, helmets covered more of the face. The need for identification markers grew.
And not just on the battlefield. The symbols then appeared on surcoats, on horse caparisons, everywhere. That was the clever part. You could see a knight from a distance and immediately know, that's so-and-so.
And it was about more than just recognition, wasn't it? There was also
honor and prestige behind it. A coat of arms was a status symbol. It showed that you belonged to a knightly house, to a lineage of warriors. The older and simpler the coat of arms, the older the noble line, or so the saying goes.
Because the later ones had to keep adding more?
Through marriages, coats of arms were combined and quartered. You'd end up with 4, 8, 16 fields. A simple coat of arms with just one symbol, that was proof of ancient nobility.
That's fascinating. From practical necessity, who's standing in front of me, to a complex system of symbols, colors, and family history. Recognizable, but the fascinating part is it didn't stop with the shield. Heraldry spread to practically everything a knight carried with him.
You mean the complete equipment?
The surcoat, for example, worn over the armor. Originally, it was a practical garment that protected the armor from sun and rain. But then it became a canvas for heraldry. The symbols were embroidered or applied as fabric pieces, sewn on. The main material was usually wool, sometimes with a linen lining.
And the production was quite elaborate. For magnificent pieces, specialized guilds worked together. Tailors, weavers, dyers, embroiderers. Simpler ones could be made by a single master craftsman with helpers.
And then there were the horse trappings, the caparisons, the helmets with the
crests. The overall effect must have been impressive. So you had a knight with a heraldic shield, surcoat in the family colors, the horse with matching caparison. It was like a walking business card.
In reenactment, we sometimes try to recreate this. Even if it's just the surcoat, you need someone who can embroider, or you have to get the appliques sewn on. And that's with modern materials. Historically, there was the added factor that the dyes themselves were expensive.
Some of the dyes had to be imported. A rich red or blue, that wasn't cheap. There was serious investment behind it.
And something I only realized later, household members wore the Lord's colors, but not necessarily the complete coat of arms. So if you had a knight with, say, red and gold as house colors, then his squires and servants also walked around in red and gold.
But not the complete coat of arms with a lion or whatever.
They wore the colors, often also badges or insignia with his symbol, but the full coat of arms on shield or banner, that was reserved for him alone.
That's actually quite sophisticated. You can tell at a glance, these are the people of such and such knight. Unity and loyalty, without everyone being allowed to bear the full coat of arms.
In reenactment, we do something similar. A group has shared colors, maybe all in green and white. But only the leader wears the actual group arms. It immediately creates visual cohesion.
And with castles?
That's where it became truly representative. The heraldic symbols on a castle showed not only who owned it, but also the family's history, the tradition, the lineage.
Especially when families were united through marriage. Then multiple coats of arms came together, quartered, sometimes even more complex. A castle with such a combined coat of arms practically told the family history carved in stone.
And the system worked on every level, from the individual knight through his household to the castle. Everything was visually connected. You could ride through a town and immediately see who was in charge here.
At a time when surnames were just becoming established, the coat of arms was the visual identity. Essentially, the name in pictorial form that everyone could recognize instantly.
And that's why it was so important that no one could simply use someone else's coat of arms. That would be like identity theft today. You would have been impersonating someone you weren't, with all the rights and obligations that entailed.
Which brings us to the question, Who actually oversaw all of this? Who decided which coat of arms belonged to whom? And who made sure the rules were followed?
The heralds.
Exactly. And that's a chapter all its own. The heralds, then. They weren't simply messengers or criers. They were central to the entire system. But let's start with the basics. Who was actually allowed to bear a coat of arms?
The term for that is armiger, right?
Armiger, in Latin. That was a genuine right, though it varied by region. You were either born with it, or it was granted to you. And sometimes it was established through usage. And this right passed to your descendants, from generation to generation.
That explains why some coats of arms have such a long history. The oldest families have been carrying the same symbol since the 12th century in some cases.
And that ties into what we already discussed about prestige. It's often said that the simpler the coat of arms, the older the family. Though, as research shows, that's not an absolutely reliable indicator. But a simple red lion on a golden background could very well point to an ancient warrior lineage.
Exactly. As we touched on earlier, the later families had to keep combining their coats of arms through marriages.
Quartering. When two noble families married, their coats of arms were united. The shield was divided, quartered, and each field showed a different family symbol.
And how complex could that
get? Extremely. There were coats of arms with 8, 16, sometimes even more fields. Each individual field told of a marriage alliance, an inheritance, a political alliance. Eventually, you needed experts just to decipher it all.
And that's exactly what the heralds were. They had to know all these coats of arms, be able to identify them, know who belonged to whom.
But that was only part of their role. The heralds were also representatives. A king's herald, he was considered the voice of the king himself.
In the diplomatic sense.
When a king's herald delivered a message, the king spoke through him. An attack on the herald was therefore often treated as an attack on the king himself, which could have massive legal consequences.
That explains why heralds were relatively safe, even in wars.
There's a story from Provence. The details aren't entirely verified historically, but it's often told. A king's herald was attacked and killed there. The punishment by the king is said to have been devastating. Whether it happened exactly that way, we don't know for certain. But it shows what status these men held.
They were essentially untouchable.
And to manage this complex system, they developed something crucial: blazoning.
The written description?
Exactly. Imagine you have a coat of arms and you want it to look the same in 100 years. If you only have a drawing, every artist interprets it differently. Proportions shift, details get lost.
So instead, they developed a verbal formula.
Blazoning follows a fixed order. First, the shield division. Then, the colors. Metals like gold and silver. Tinctures like red, blue, black. Then, the charges. Then, details like the arming and tongue on animals.
Arming?
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
The claws of a lion, for example. Or the tongue. It can be a different color from the rest of the animal. The English royal coat of arms. Gules, three lines passant guardant. Or armed and langued azure. Every heraldist immediately knows what's meant, no matter where or when.
And that's been working since the 13th century.
The descriptions were originally in Latin or French. Different artists could create different interpretations, but the essence of the coat of arms remained intact. The three lions of England look different on a 14th century manuscript than on a modern document, but they are clearly the same three lions.
That's actually brilliant. You create a standard that's flexible enough for artistic freedom, yet precise enough for clarity.
The heralds were the
guardians of this standard.
They kept rolls of arms, documented who bore which coat of arms, settled disputes. A complete administrative system for visual identity, centuries before trademark law and corporate design.
And much of it has survived to this day. Now, we've talked about the rules, but one aspect is particularly important to me, the colors. They weren't chosen randomly.
There's a very practical principle behind it. Heraldry distinguishes between metals and tinctures. Metals are gold, meaning yellow, and silver, meaning white. The tinctures are the actual colors: red, blue, green, black, purple.
And the basic rule was metal not on metal, color not on color. This ensured better visibility. Though there were exceptions.
The contrast had to be right. A golden line on a red background, perfectly visible. A golden line on a silver background? That blurs at a distance. The original problem, how do I recognize someone on the battlefield, was solved through these contrast rules.
That's essentially early graphic design. Maximum legibility under difficult conditions.
The three golden lines on a red background for England are a perfect example. Clear, high contrast, unmistakable.
And we still see these lines today, don't we? I mean, not just on old documents.
The English national football team wears them on their jersey.
It's interesting that a modern sports team connects so directly
to Richard the Lionheart. That actually goes back to the Crusades, late 12th century. Richard demonstrably introduced the three golden lions. The first seal dates from 1195. Earlier kings also used lions, but not these three. And this symbol became the royal coat of arms of England.
So when millions of people watch a football match today and see the English jersey, they're looking at a symbol that's 800 years old.
800 years. And it still works. Identification, belonging, recognition. Exactly what heraldry was invented for.
That really shows how timeless the system is. Sports clubs, cities, universities. We find heraldic elements everywhere. Sometimes obvious, sometimes, what do you call it, hidden in more modern designs.
And it's still used practically today. Wax seals with your own coat of arms for important documents. That has no legal significance anymore, neither in Germany nor in England. But it carries a ceremonial, identity-affirming character.
And modern coats of arms are actually still being granted. They can contain contemporary symbols. The blog post mentions computer keyboards, fishing nets, anything that reflects the bearer's identity.
A fisherman from Cornwall could receive a coat of arms today with nets and boats. An IT entrepreneur with symbols from the digital world. The language is the same, only the vocabulary keeps growing.
I find that fascinating. A system that originated in the 12th century to distinguish armored horsemen is flexible enough to still be relevant in the 21st century.
From colorful shields on the battlefield to company logos and sports emblems. The basic idea, visual identity, belonging, tradition, remains the same.
And with that, we've reached the end of our journey through the world of heraldry. From the first collective symbols of the Greek city-states, through the complex rules of blazoning,
to the three lions on modern football jerseys.
If you want to learn more about topics like these, visit battlemerchant.com. On the blog, you'll find many more exciting articles about history, the Middle Ages, and everything that goes with it.
And who knows, maybe this will inspire you to design your own coat of arms. The tradition lives on.
Until next time.
Take care.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.